where. The letters of credit won't vanish. The organizations will continue operating under new authorities. At least, that's my conclusion. Do you find it to be an error, Arkadan?
Not necessarily.
Nor I, says Forsyte. Our few ties to Kamor are secure, our obligations to it non-existent. Who can name a single concrete injury we would do ourselves if we accepted the Anatolia's contract?
The chamber is silent. I trust we may consider the first mandate dispensed with, says the falconer. Let's give due airing to the second. What Anatolius proposes and offers to pay a fair, which is to say exorbitant price for, is that we engineer an opportunity for him to work his revenge against the nobility of Kamor and against its foremost criminal family. Now, I am merely being exact. I'm not attempting to disguise the magnitude of his intentions. With our aid, Anatolius will likely succeed, and hundreds of the most powerful men and women in Kamor will be gentled. Our sister navigator is correct to point out the foolishness of dancing around this point. These men and women will never again have a single meaningful thought. They won't be able to wipe the filth from their own asses. Their fate will be tantamount to murder. I would certainly not wish that on anyone I knew or cared for. But then, we are here to consider, as the Arkadama put it, the concrete injuries of our actions, not to hone our sympathy for distant persons. We must measure whether the disruption this would inflict could be so widespread as to compromise our own interests and our freedom of action.
Forgive my suspicion, says Jean, patience, that the speaker has come to this assembly well armed with conclusions to aid us in that measurement.
Arkadama, I would be a poor advocate indeed if I dared to speak extemporaneously on such a crucial matter. I've given this contract a great deal of thought since it was first proposed.
If it were carried out, says Arkadama Forsyte, what would happen to Kamor?
I think it impossible, says the falconer, that literally every noble in Kamor could be caught in this trap. There must inevitably be those too ill to attend, those out of favor at court, and those traveling abroad. There will also be those that leave too early or arrive too late. Dozens of them are sure to survive. Anatolius understands this. His point is made regardless. Kamor possesses a standing army of several companies, along with a rather infamous constabulary. At the end of the night, the survivors would retain a disciplined force to keep the peace.
That's what they'd be used for, then?
Arkadon Providence adopts a tone of mock surprise.
Certainly not to settle old scores. Kamori are so famous for their deep sense of restraint where lingering grudges are concerned.
I'm not trying to be fatuous, Arkadon, says the falconer, or unduly optimistic, but our information, and our information is better than the Duke of Kamor's, is that the Duke's standing forces are reasonably loyal to the throne and to Kamor itself. Of course, there'd be blood on the walls, doors kicked in, alley fights, that personal Kamori touch. Yet I think it likely the army and constabulary would stand aside from these affairs until the strongest survivors restored a legitimate chain of command.
Are you seriously arguing, says Providence, that Kamor would, after a few knife fights in the dark, suffer no further instability from the sudden and rather horrific subtraction of several hundred nobles?
Of course not. Arkadon, you do me a rhetorical injustice. Kamor will lose much. Its present ambitions, its particular relations with other city-states, its high culture. If Anatolius has his way, he'll wipe out most of the old dogs who won the Thousand Days and put down the Mad Count's rebellion. Kamor will be severely tested. Tal Varrar, we must assume, will poke every visible wound. But will Kamor collapse? Will there be riots in the streets? Will its soldiers throw down their pikes and run to the wilds? Gods be gracious, no. And will it lash out? At whom? Anatolius intends to make it generally known, if his plan is successful, that what took place was an act of vengeance by Kamori upon Kamori. There'll be no foreign phantoms to chase.
They will try, says Temperance musingly. And they'll hunt Anatolius to the ends of creation.
Assassins will be lined up at the city gates for work.
I agree, says the falconer, but that would be Anatolius' problem, and he's eager to have it. He knows how to reach our agents if he wishes to discuss the price of making himself vanish.
There is a good-humored murmur from around the chamber. The sun has climbed higher. The warm golden glow is steady.
I believe the chaos unleashed by Anatolius' plan would be brief, local, and easily contained, says the falconer. It is, of course, the place of the Archmagi to determine whether or not I've been convincing. But I would say one thing more. A decision here is only the first requirement for a contract to be placed into action. It must also have a mage willing to become its instrument. I am no hypocrite. If the Archmagi allow it, I would be the first to request the honor of the assignment.
Jean feels a strange flare of emotion from somewhere below the surface of the memories he rides. It isn't anger or even surprise, rather satisfaction, anticipation. The hint of feeling vanishes quickly, pushed back behind the curtains of Patience's mental stage.
Are there any further arguments to be made, says Temperance, against the Anatolius proposal on the basis of the second mandate?
Silence around the room.
We call the question.
Temperance raises his left hand, a gesture that allows his sleeve to fall back just far enough to reveal his five rings.
Have these arguments changed the opinions already offered by my peers?
I still can't deem it acceptable, says Providence.
I can, says Foresight. Then the time has come for Patience and me to make our declarations.
Temperance broods before continuing.
I agree that this is a proposal without precedent. I agree that it seems a singular and sinister thing, and I am no enemy of black contracts. But our custom compels a duty to fact, not to vague impressions. I find no valid reason in law to disqualify the proposal.
A critical moment. Temperance has handed Patience the most meaningful decision of the entire assembly. If she refuses the proposal, agents of the Bonds Magi will politely inform Luciano Anatolius that his proposition has not been found convenient. If she allows the proposal, the falconer will go to Camor to work an act of butchery.
I share the qualms of the Honorable Navigator and our esteemed Archidon Providence, Jean Patience says at last. I also share the Archidon Temperance's respect for the strictness of our mandates. I, too, lack any valid reason to disallow the contract.
Jean is chilled to the core of his vaporous body as he feels this statement come from his, Patience's, lips. Of all the curious privileges he has ever been granted in life, surely this is among the most awful. The chance to speak the words that sent the falconer to Camor, to slaughter the Barsavi family, to cause the deaths of Carlo and Galdo and Bug, to come within a hair's width of killing himself and Locke.
The proposal is accepted, says Temperance. I think it no small justice that the task should be yours, falconer. We know you have the stomach for black contracts. Now we'll see if your subtlety is any match for your enthusiasm.
The falconer has been handed a double-edged opportunity, a chance to crown his relatively early success with a contract unlike any other, a chance to fail spectacularly if he lacks the nerve to pull it off.
This assembly is adjourned, says Temperance.
Jean's perception shifts again. In mid-sentence, the sound of the eldest Archidon's voice transmutes to the sensation of thoughts. Patience has returned to her natural perspective. Like a theatre audience with no applause, the Magi rise and begin to file out of the Sky Chamber. 100 private discussions continue, but there is no need to form conversational knots and clusters when they are taking place in the swift silence of thought. The other Archmagi rise to leave, but Jean Patience lingers, staring at the pool of dream steel in the middle of the chamber. He/she can feel the falconer's eyes from across the room.
I must admit, I wasn't expecting you to make that allowance, Mother.
If you're no hypocrite, neither am I.
Jean Patience waves a hand across the surface of the dream steel. Currents of warmth pulse up and down the ghostly fingers. The silvery metal ripples birth slender shapes. The sculpting takes a few moments and is far from perfect, but soon enough Jean Patience has beckoned the dream steel into a caricature of the Camor skyline, with the five towers looming over islands studded with smaller buildings.
Having no excuse to forbid this isn't the same as condoning it.
Frame it as you like.
Is there any point to my offering a piece of advice?
If it's truly advice, I'll be surprised.
Don't go to Camor. This contract isn't just complex, it's dangerous.
I thought as much. Dangerous? I don't recall my name being on Luciano Anatolius' list of enemies.
Not merely dangerous for the ungifted, dangerous for you.
Oh, Mother, I hardly know whether your game is too deep or too shallow for me. Is this your legendary prescience again? Curious how you seem to cite it whenever you have an obvious reason to slow me down.
The falconer stretches forth a hand, and the five towers sink. In seconds, the liquid sculpture buildings dissolve back into their primordial silver ooze. The dream steel quivers, then becomes mirror smooth once again. The falconer grins.
Some day, speaker, you may have cause to regret the intensity of your self-regard.
Yes, well, perhaps we can continue to explore your rather thorough catalogue of my faults when I return from Camor. Until then...
I doubt we'll ever have the opportunity. Farewell, falconer.
Farewell, Mother. Rest assured, I do look forward to enjoying the last word, whenever it comes.
He turns toward the door. As he walks away, Vestris cocks her head slightly, stares with cold hunter's eyes, and makes the slightest squawk, the bird's equivalent of a disdainful laugh. The falconer departs on his mission to Camor 2 days later. When he returns, months will have passed, and he will be in no condition to enjoy any words at all. 5.
Gods above!
Whispered Jean as the deck of the Skyreacher became real beneath his feet again. His eyes felt as though he'd been staring into a bitter wind. It was a deep relief to find himself back in the familiar shape and mass of his own body.
That was insane!
The first time isn't easy. You bore it well enough.
You people do that often?
Asked Jean.
I wouldn't go so far as often.
You can just pass your memories back and forth, said Locke, shaking his head, like an old jacket.
Not quite. The technique requires preparation and conscious guidance. I couldn't simply give you the sum total of my memories, or teach you to speak Vadran with a touch.
Kaspras Vadrani Anhalt.
Yes, I know you do.
Falconer, muttered Jean, rubbing his eyes. Falconer! Patience, you could have stopped him. You were inclined to stop him.
I was, said Patience. She stared out at the Amethel, the cooling dregs of her tea forgotten.
But the falconer was one of your exceptionalists, right? Said Locke, along with what's-her-name, Foresight. And here you had a contract, a mission, to go and really fuck things up, Therim Pell style. If he'd actually pulled it off, and he came God's damned close, let me tell you, isn't that just the sort of thing that would have given more prestige to his faction?
Absolutely.
And yet you let him go anyway.
I thought of abstaining until he announced his willingness to take the contract. No, his intention of taking the contract. Once he'd done so, I realized that he wouldn't be coming back safely from Camor.
What, you had some sort of premonition?
After a fashion. It's one of my talents.
Patience, said Locke. I would like to ask you something deeply personal, not to antagonize you. I ask because your son helped kill 4 close friends of mine, and I want to know, I guess.
You want to know why we don't get along?
Yes.
He hated me. Patience wrung her hands together. Still does, behind the fog of his madness. He hates me as much as he did when we parted that day in the Sky Chamber.
Why?
It's simple, and yet rather hard to explain. The first thing you should understand is how we choose our names.
Falconer, Navigator, Coldmarrow, etc., said Jean.
Yes, we call them grey names because they're mist. They're insubstantial.
Every mage chooses a grey name when their first ring is tattooed on their wrist. Cold Marrow, for example, chose his in memory of his northern heritage.
What were you before you were Patience? Said Jean.
I called myself Seamstress. She smiled faintly. Not all grey names are grandiose. Now there's another sort of name. We call it the red name, the name that lives in the blood, the true name which can never be shed.
Like mine, muttered Jean.
Just so. The second thing you need to understand is that magical talent has no relation to heredity. It doesn't breed true. Many decades of regrettable interference in the private lives of magi made this abundantly clear.
What do you do, said Jean, with, ungifted children when you have them?
Cherish them and raise them, you imbecile. Most of them end up working for us in Carthane and elsewhere. What did you think we'd do, burn them on a pyre?
Forget I asked.
And gifted children, said Locke. Where do they come from, if they're not homegrown?
A trained mage can sense an unschooled talent, said Patience. We usually catch them very young. They're brought to Carthane and raised in our unique community. Sometimes their original memories are suppressed for their own comfort.
But not the Falconer, said Locke. You said he was your flesh and blood, son.
Yes.
And for him to have the power, how rare is that?
He was the fifth in 400 years.
Was his father a mage?
A master gardener, said Patience softly. He drowned on the Emethel 6 months after our son was born.
I'm sorry.
Of course you're not.
Patience moved her fingers slightly and her tea mug disappeared.
I suppose I might have gone mad if not for the Falconer. He was my solace. We became so close, that little boy and I. We explored his talents together. Ultimately, though, for magi to be born of magi is more curse than blessing.
Why?
Said Jean.
You've been Jean Tannen all your life. It's what your mother and father called you when you were learning how to speak. It's engraved on your soul. Your friend here also has a red name, but to his great good fortune, he stumbled into a grey name for himself at an early age. He calls himself Locke Lamora, but deep down inside, when he thinks of himself, he thinks something else.
Locke smiled thinly and nibbled a biscuit.
The very first identity that we accept and recognize as us, that's what becomes the red name. When we grow from the raw instincts of infancy and discover that we exist, conscious and separate from the things around us. Most of us acquire red names from what our parents whisper to us over and over, until we learn to repeat it in our own thoughts.
Huh, said Locke. An instant later he spat crumbs.
Holy shit! You know the Falconer's true name because you gave it to him.
I tried to avoid it, said Patience. Oh, I tried. But I was lying to myself. You can't love a baby and not give him a name. If my husband had lived, he would have given the Falconer a secret name. That was the procedure. Other magi might have intervened, would have, if I hadn't deceived them. I wasn't thinking straight. I needed that private bond with my boy so desperately, and inevitably I named him.
He resented you for it, said Jean.
A mage's deepest secret, said Patience. Never shared, not between masters and students, closest friends, even husbands and wives. A mage who learns another mage's true name wields absolute power over them. My son has bitterly resented me since the moment he realized what I held over him, whether or not I ever chose to use it.
Crooked warden, said Locke. I guess I should be able to find it in my heart to have some sympathy for the poor bastard, but I can't. I sure as hell wish you'd had a normal son.
I think I've said enough for the time being.
Patience moved away from the taffrail and turned her back to Locke and Jean.
You two rest. We can dispose of any further questions when you awake.
I could sleep, admitted Locke. For 7 or 8 years, I think. Have someone kick the door in at the end of the month if I'm not out yet. And Patience, I guess I am sorry for...
You're a curious man, Master Lamora. You bite on reflex, and then your conscience bites you. Have you ever wondered where you might have acquired such contradictory strains of character?
I don't repent anything I said, Patience, but I do occasionally remember to try and be civil after the fact. As you said, I'm not dragging you to Carthane to be anyone's friend, least of all mine. Go take some rest. We'll talk after.
6. Jean hadn't realized just how exhausted the long night had left him, and after settling into his hammock he tumbled into the sort of sleep that squashed awareness as thoroughly as a few hundred pounds of bricks dropped on the head. He woke, groggy and disoriented, to the smell of baked meat and crisp lake air. Locke was sitting at a smaller version of the makeshift table on which he'd been subjected to the cleansing ritual, hard at work on another small mountain of ship's fare. Jean rolled to his feet and heard his joints creak and pop. His bruises from the encounter with Cortessa would smart for a few days, but bruises were bruises. He'd had them before.
What's the time?
5th hour of the afternoon, said Locke around a mouthful of food. We should be in Carthane just before dawn, they say. Jean yawned, rubbed his eyes, and considered the scene. Locke was dressed in loose, clean slops, evidently chosen from an open chest of clothing set against the bulkhead behind him.
How do you feel, Locke?
Bloody hungry. He wiped his lips against the back of his hand and took a swig of water. This is worse than Velvirazzo. Wherever we go, I seem to get thinner and thinner.
I'd have thought you'd still be sleeping.
I had a will for it, but my stomach wouldn't be put off. You, if you'll forgive me, look like a man desperately in search of coffee.
I don't smell any. Suppose you drank it all?
Come now, even I'm not that much of a scoundrel. Never was any aboard. Seems patience is big on tea.
Damn, tea's no good for waking up civilized.
What's boiling in that muddled brain of yours?
I suppose I'm bemused.
Jean took one of the two empty chairs at the table, picked up a knife and used it to slide some ham onto a slab of bread.
And dizzy. Our Lady of the Five Rings has spun our situation well beyond anything I expected.
That she has. You think it's odd from where you're sitting?
It is.
Jean ate and studied Locke. He'd cleaned up, shaved, and pulled the lengthening mass of his hair into a short tail. The removal of his beard made the marks of his convalescence plain. He was pale, looking far more Vadran than Therin for a change, and the creases at the edges of his mouth were graven a bit deeper, the lines beneath his eyes more pronounced. Some invisible sculptor had been at work the past few weeks, carving the first real hints of age into the face Jean had known for nearly 20 years.
Where on the God's fair earth are you putting all that food, Locke?
If I knew that, I'd be a physicker. Jean took another look around the cabin. A copper tub had been set near the stern windows, and beside it a pile of towels and oil bottles.
Wondering about the tub, said Locke. Water's fresh. They replaced it after I was done. They don't expect us to go diving in the lake to make ourselves presentable.
There was a knock at the cabin door. Jean glanced at Locke, and Locke nodded.
Come!
Yelled Jean.
I knew you were awake, said Patience.
She came down the steps, made a casual gesture, and the door shut itself behind her. She settled into the third chair and folded her hands in her lap.
Are we proving ourselves adequate hosts?
We seem to be well kept, said Jean with a yawn, excepting a barbaric absence of coffee.
Endure for another day, Master Tannen, and you'll have all the foul black misuse of water you can drink.
What happened to the last person you hired to rig this little game of yours, Patience? Said Jean.
Straight to business, eh? Said Locke.
I don't mind, said Patience. It's why I'm here. But what do you mean?
You do this every 5 years, said Jean. You choose to work through agents that can't be bonds magi. So what happened to the last set you hired? Where are they? Can we speak to them?
Ah, you're wondering whether we tied weights around their ankles and threw them into the lake when it was over.
Something like that.
In some cases, we traded services. In others, we offered payments. All of our former exemplars, regardless of compensation, left our service freely and in good health.
So, you ruthlessly protect every aspect of your privacy for centuries, but every few years you pick a special friend, answer any questions they might have, show them your fucking memories, begging your pardon, and then you just send them off when you've finished, with a cheerful wave?
None of our previous exemplars ever crippled a bondsmaid, Jean. None of them were ever shown what you were. But you needn't flatter yourself that you've been made privy to some shattering secret that can only be preserved by the most extreme measures. When this is over, we expect confidentiality for the rest of your lives, and if that courtesy isn't granted, you both know that we'll never have any difficulty tracking at least one of you down.
I guess that works, said Jean sourly. So who took the ribbon last time you did this?
You're being entrusted with a winning tradition, said Patience. Though two victories in a row doesn't quite make a dynasty, it's a good basis from which to expect a third. Now, we will discuss your work in Carthane, but I made an unusual promise to get you both here. I would have it fulfilled for good and all. Have you any further questions about my people, about our arts?
Ask now or forever bite our tongues, said Locke.
I offered a brief opportunity, not a scholarly treatise.
As it happens, said Locke, I do have one last thing I want a real answer to. Jean asked about the contracts you take. He asked why, and you gave us a why not. But I don't think that cuts to the heart of things. I can't imagine that you people actually need the money after 400 years. Am I wrong?
No. I could touch sums at an hour's notice that would buy a city-state, said Patience.
So why are you still mercenaries? Why build your world around it? Why do you call yourselves Bonds Magi without flinching? Why, Incipa Vela Armatos Dei?
Ah, said Patience, this is a deeper draught than you might wish to take.
Let me be the judge.
As you will. When did the Vadrans start raiding the northern coasts, where the Kingdom of the Marrows is now?
What the hell does that have to do with anything?
Indulge me. When did they first come down from that miserable waste of theirs, whatever their word for it?
Crystal Vasen, said Jean, the glass land.
About 800 years ago, said Locke, so I was taught.
And how long since the Therin people moved onto this continent from across the Iron Sea?
2,000 years, maybe, said Locke.
800 years of Vadran history, said Patience. 2,000 for the Therin. The Siresti and the Golden Brethren are older still. Let's generously give them 3,000 years. Now, what if I told you that we had reason to believe that some of the Eldran ruins on this continent were built more than 20,000 years ago? Perhaps even 30,000?
That's pretty damned wild, said Locke.
How can you—
We have means, said Patience with a dismissive wave. They're not important. What's important is this. No one in recorded history has ever made a credible claim of meeting the Eldran. Whatever they were, they vanished so long ago that our ancestors didn't leave us any stories about meeting them in the flesh. By the time we took their empty cities, only the gods could know how long they'd been deserted. Now, one glance at these cities tells us they were masters of a sorcery that makes ours look like an idiot's card tricks by comparison. They built miracles, and built them to last for hundreds of centuries. The Eldran meant to tend their garden here for a very, very long time.
What made them leave? Said Locke.
I used to scare myself as a kid by thinking about this, said Jean.
You can scare yourself now by thinking about it, said Patience. Indeed, Locke, what made them leave? There are two possibilities. Either something wiped them out, or something frightened them so badly that they abandoned all their cities and treasures in their haste to be gone.
Leave the world? Said Locke. Where would they go?
We don't have the faintest speck of an idea, said Patience. But regardless of how their marvelous cities were emptied in advance of our tenancy, it happened. Something out there made it happen. We have to assume that something could return.
Gah! Said Locke, putting his head in his hands. Patience, you're a regular bundle of smiles, you know that?
I warned you this might not be cheering.
This world and all its souls are the sovereign estate of the 13, said Locke. They rule it, protect it, and tend the mechanisms of nature. Hell, maybe they were the ones that kicked the Eldran out.
Strange, then, that they wouldn't mention it to us explicitly, said Patience.
Patience, let me reveal something from personal experience, said Locke.
The gods tell us what we need to know. But when you start asking about things you really just want to know, you'd best expect long pauses in the conversation.
Inconvenient, said Patience. Of course, it's possible that the gods are keeping mum about what happened to the Eldarin. Or they couldn't act to stop it. Or wouldn't. We've spent centuries arguing these possibilities. The only sensible assumption is that we've got to take care on our own behalf.
How? Said Locke.
The use of sorcery in a long-term fashion, in a grand and concerted manner, with many magi working together, leaves an indelible imprint upon the world. Persons and forces sensitive to magic can detect this phenomenon, just as you can look at a river and tell which direction it's flowing, and put your hand in the water to tell how fast and warm it is. Great workings are like burning beacons on a clear, dark night. Somewhere out in the darkness, we must assume, are things it would be in our best interest not to signal. That's why we maintain only a handful of places like the Sky Chamber, and prefer not to spend our time building 50-story towers out of glass. We suspect the Eldarin paid for their lack of subtlety. They made themselves obvious to some power they didn't necessarily need to cross paths with.
Did the ritual you used to get rid of that poison...
Oh, hardly. It was a significant piece of work. Any mage within 20 miles would have felt it, but what I'm talking about requires a great deal more time and trouble. And that, at last, is why we've made our contract such a focus of our lives. Working toward the diverging goals of thousands upon thousands of others over the years dissipates the magical consequences of concentrating our power. Think of us as a few hundred tiny flames crackling in the night. By sparking randomly at different times in different directions, we avoid the danger of flaring together into one vast and visible conflagration.
I congratulate you, said Locke. My mind has been thoroughly bent. But I think I sort of understand. Your little guild, if what you're saying is true, you didn't band together just to keep the peace or any bullshit like that. This Eldarin thing really spooks you.
Yes, she said. The court magicians of the last few years of the Therin throne were out of control. Circles of pure ambition working to undermine one another. They wouldn't heed reason. The founders of our order brought their concerns to Emperor Talathri and were laughed off. But we knew the truth of the matter. If human sorcery is to exist at all, it must be quiet and disciplined, or we risk first-hand knowledge of the fate of the Eldarin.
Pardon my limited understanding of your powers, said Jean, but what you did to Therin Pell was anything but quiet.
Or disciplined, said Patience. Yes, it was precisely the sort of focused, grand-scale will-working we can't afford. But on that one occasion, it was a necessary risk. The Imperial Seat, its infrastructure, its archives, all the heritable trappings of power had to be obliterated. Without Therin Pell, any would-be restorer of the Empire found the easy path to legitimacy swept away. We needed that security in our early years.
While you hunted down any magician that wouldn't join you, said Locke.
Without mercy, said Patience. You're right not to think of us as altruists. Certainly we can be hard, but perhaps you'll grant now that our motivations are, if not philanthropic, at least complicated.
Locke merely grunted and spooned porridge into his mouth.
Have I satisfied you on this matter?
Locke nodded and swallowed. I'm afraid that if you tell me any more, I'll never be able to sleep in a dark room again. Shall we talk about our business in Carthane? Said Jean. Sensing that he and Locke were both in the mood for a less disquieting subject.
The 5-year game, said Patience. Are the two of you ready for details?
My fighting spirit's back in residence, said Locke. I've been stuck in bed for weeks. Turn me loose with a list of laws you want broken.
Are you sure you don't want any tea, Jean? Said Patience.
No, said Jean. Not for breaking fast. I wouldn't say no to red wine, though. Good rugged paint-stripping stuff. Plonk with sand in it. That's a good planning wine.
I'll see to it.
So, said Locke, we work for your faction. I presume that's you, Cold Marrow, Navigator, all you high-minded types who only slaughter people when they've been naughty little children. What about your fellow 5 ringers? Where do they stand? Providence and Temperance will be cheering for you. Foresight, as I'm sure will be no surprise, will be hoping for you to slip and break your neck.
Foresight and the Falconer's lot, that's the other team. Just two sides, no splinter factions, no lurking surprises, said Locke.
We only have enough major disagreements to supply two factions, I'm afraid.
The door slipped open, and Cold Marrow entered with a tray. He set down an open bottle of red wine, several glasses, and Patience's mug from the previous night. He then handed Patience two scrolls and withdrew as soundlessly as he'd come. Patience took her tea mug in hand. There was a sizzling noise, and a cloud of steam wafted from the cup. Jean poured two glasses of wine and set one in front of Locke. He took a swig from his own. It tasted like something out of a tanning vat.
Ah, he said, demonic ass wash. Just the thing.
I'm not sure we meant that for drinking, said Patience. Possibly for repelling boarders.
Smells adequate to the task, said Locke, adding water to his glass.
Now these, said Patience, pushing the scrolls toward Locke and Jean with her free hand, would be you.
Jean picked up his scroll, snapped the seal, and found that it was actually several tightly rolled documents. He scanned them and saw Lashani letters of transit.
For Tavrin Callus, he scowled.
An old and comfortable piece of clothing, I should think, said Patience with a smirk.
Beneath the letters of transit, which were a reasonably common means for travellers to prove themselves something less than total vagabonds, there was a letter of credit at one Tivoli's counting house for the sum of 3,000 Carthani ducats. If he wanted to lay claim to that money, of course, he'd have to accept his old alias one more time.
Cheer up, Jean, said Locke. I'm Sebastian Lazari, it seems. Never heard of the fellow.
I apologize if the selection of your own false faces is part of the savor for you, said Patience. We needed to set up those accounts and put other things into motion before we fetched you out of Lachaine.
This is swell, said Locke. Don't think we can't start working with this, now that my nerves are more settled, but I hope this isn't the fullness of our suckle on the golden teat.
Those are merely your setting-up funds, to get you through your first few days. Tivoli will put you in control of your working treasury. 100,000 ducats, same as your opposition. A goodly sum for graft and other needs, but not so much that you can simply drench Carthane in money and win without being clever.
And, if we set aside a little for afterward, said Locke,
we encourage you to spend these funds down to the last copper on the election itself, said Patience, since anything left over when the results are confirmed will disappear as though by magic. Clear?
Frustratingly damn clear, said Locke. How does this election work at the most basic level? Said Jean.
There are 14 districts in the city, and 5 representing the rural manors. 19 seats on the ruling conseil. Each political party stands 1 candidate per seat, and designates a line of seconds in case the primary candidate is embroiled in scandal or otherwise distracted. That tends to happen with curious frequency.
No shit, said Locke. What are these political parties?
2 major interests dominate Carthane. On one hand, there's the Deep Roots Party, old aristocracy. They've all been legally debased out of their titles, but the money and connections are still there. On the other side, you've got the Black Iris Party, artisans, younger merchants, old money versus new, let's say.
Who are we taking care of? Said Jean.
You've got the Deep Roots.
How? I mean, what are we to these people?
Lashani consultants, hired to direct the campaign behind the scenes. Your power will be more or less absolute.
Who's told these people to listen to us?
They've been adjusted, Jean. They'll defer enthusiastically to you, at least where the election is concerned. We've prepared them for your arrival.
Gods!
It's nothing you don't try to do with raw charm and fancy stories. We just work faster.
We've got 6 weeks, is that right? Said Locke.
Yes, Patience sipped at her tea. The formal commencement of electoral hostilities is the night after tomorrow.
And this Deep Roots Party, said Locke. You said they've won the last 2 elections?
Oh, no, said Patience.
You did, said Jean. You said we were being entrusted with a winning tradition.
Ah, pardon. I meant that my faction of Magi has backed the winning party of Ungifted twice in a row. It's a matter of chance, you see, which party either side gets. The Deep Roots have been rather lackluster these past 10 years, but during those years fortune gave us the Black Iris. Now, alas, God's immaculate piss, muttered Locke.
What are the limits on our behavior? Said Jean.
As far as the Ungifted are concerned, not many. You'll be working with people eager to help you break every election law ever scribed, so long as you don't do anything bloody or vulgar.
No violence? Said Locke.
Brawls are a natural consequence of enthusiasm, said Patience. Everyone loves to hear about a good fist fight. But keep it at fists. No weapons, no corpses. You can knock a few Karthani about and make whatever threats you like, but you cannot kill anyone. Nor can you kidnap any citizen of Carthane or physically remove them from the city. Those rules are enforced by my people. I should think the reasons are obvious.
Right. You're not paying us to assassinate the entire Black Aris bunch and ride off into the sunset.
Your own situation is more ambiguous, said Patience. You two and your counterpart controlling the Black Iris should expect anything, including kidnapping. Guard your own backs. Only outright murder is forbidden in your respect.
Well, that's cheery, said Locke. About this counterpart, what do we get to know?
You know quite a bit already.
What do you mean?
It's uncomfortable news, said Patience. But we've learned that at least one person within the ranks of my faction is passing information to Arkedama Foresight.
Well, that's bloody careless of you.
We're working on the situation. At any rate, Foresight and her associates learned of my intention to hire you several weeks ago. They acquired a direct countermeasure.
Meaning what?
You and Jean have a unique background in deception, disguise, and manipulation. You're a rare breed. In fact, there's only one other person left in the world with intimate knowledge of your methods and training.
Locke shot to his feet as though his chair were a crossbow and the trigger had been pulled. His glass flew, spilling watered wine across the tabletop.
No, he said. No! You're fucking kidding! No!
Yes, said Patience. My rivals have hired your old friend Sabatha Bellacoros to be their exemplar. She's been in Carthane for several days now, making her preparations. It's a fair bet that she's laying surprises for the two of you as we speak.
Part 2. Cross Purposes. When the roses flash to the sunset, reels to the rack and the twist, and the rose is a red bygone, when the face I love is going, and the gate to the end shall clang, and it's no use to beckon or say, so long, maybe I'll tell you then, some other time. Carl Sandburg, from The Great Hunt. Interlude. Striking Sparks. 1. It was cool and dark in the elderglass burrow of the gentleman bastards, and far quieter than usual, when Locke awoke with the certain knowledge that someone was staring at him. He caught his breath for an instant, then mimicked the deep, slow breathing of sleep. He squinted and scanned the grey darkness of the room, wondering where everyone was. Down the hall from the kitchen there were 4 rooms, or more appropriately, 4 cells. They had dark curtains for doors. One belonged to Chains, another to Sabatha, the third to the Sansas, and the fourth to Locke and Jean. Jean should have been on his cot against the opposite wall, just past their little shelf of books and scrolls, but there was no sound from that direction. Locke listened, straining to hear over the thudding of his pulse. There was a whisper of bare skin against the floor, and a flutter of cloth. He sat up, left hand outstretched, only to find another warm set of fingers entwined around his, and a palm in the middle of his chest pushing him back down.
"Shh," said Sabatha, sliding onto the cot.
"What? Where is everyone?"
"Gone for the moment," she whispered into his ear. Her breath was warm against his cheek.
"We don't have much time, but we do have some."
She took his hands and guided them to the smooth, taut muscles of her stomach. Then she slid them upwards until he was cupping her breasts. She'd come into the room without a tunic. One thing the bodies of 16-year-old boys, and that was more or less what Locke was, Don't do is respond mildly to provocation. In an instant he was achingly hard against the thin fabric of his breeches, and he exhaled in mingled shock and delight. Sabitha brushed aside his blanket and slid her left hand down between his legs. Locke arched his back and uttered a noise that was far from dignified. Luckily, Sabitha giggled, seeming to find it endearing. She whispered,
"I do feel appreciated."
She pressed down firmly but gently and began to squeeze him to the rhythm of their breathing, which was growing steadily louder. At the same time, she slid his other hand down from her breast, down her stomach, down to her legs. She was wearing a linen breech-clout, the sort that could be undone with just a tug in the right place. She pressed his hand between her thighs, against the intriguing heat just behind the fabric. He caressed her there, and for a few incredible moments they were completely caught up in this half-sharing, half-duel, their responses to one another becoming less controlled with every ragged breath, and it was delicious suspense to wonder who would snap first.
"You're driving me mad," he whispered.
The heat from her skin was so intense he imagined he could see it as a ghost image in the dark. She leaned forward, and her breath tickled his cheeks again. He drew in the scents of her hair and sweat and perfume and laughed with pleasure.
"Why are we still wearing clothes?"
she said, and they rolled apart to amend the situation, fumbling, struggling, giggling. Only now the soft heat of her skin was fading, and the grey shadows of the room loomed more deeply around them, and then Locke was kicking out, spasming in a full-body reflex as she slipped from his grasp like a breath of wind. That cruelest of landlords, cold morning reality, finished evicting the warm fantasy that had briefly taken up residence in his skull. Muttering and swearing, Locke fought against his tangled blanket, felt his cot tipping away from the wall, and failed in every particular to brace himself for his meeting with the floor. There are three distinct points of impact no romantically excited teenage boy ever hopes to slam against a hard surface. Locke managed to land on all three. His outflung right hand failed to do anything useful, but it did snatch the opaque cover from his cot-side alchemical globe, bathing the cell in soft golden light for him to gasp and writhe by. A carelessly stacked pile of books toppled loudly to the floor, then took several similar piles with it in a fratricidal cascade.
"Gods below!" muttered Jean, rolling away from the light.
Jean was definitely in his proper place, and their cell was once again the cluttered mess of daily life rather than the dark private stage of Locke's dream.
"Argh!"
said Locke. It didn't help much, so he tried again.
"Argh! You know," said Jean, yawning irritably, "you should burn some offerings in thanks for the fact that you don't actually talk in your sleep."
"Argh!
What the hell do you mean?"
"Sabitha's got really sharp ears."
"I mean, it's pretty goddamned obvious you're not dreaming about calligraphy over there."
There was a loud knock on the wall just outside their cell, and then the curtain was swept aside to reveal Carlo Sanza, long hair hanging in his eyes, working his way into a pair of breeches.
"Good morning, sunshines! What's with all the noise?"
"Someone took a tumble," muttered Jean.
"What's so hard about sleeping on a cot like a normal person, you fucking spastic dog?"
"Kiss my ass, Sansa," Locke gasped.
"Hey, everybody!"
Carlo pounded on the wall as he shouted.
"I know we've got half an hour yet to sleep, but Locke thinks we should all be up right now. Find your happy faces, gentle fucker bastards. It's a bright new day and we get to start it early."
"Carlo, what the hell is wrong with you?"
hollered Sabitha somewhere down the hall. Locke put his forehead against the floor and moaned. It was the height of the endless steaming summer of the 78th year of Preva, Lady of the Red Madness, and everything was absolutely screwed up to hell. 2. Sabitha darted in, parried Locke's attempt at a guard, and smacked the outside of his left knee with her chestnut wood baton.
"Ow!"
he said, hopping up and down while the sting faded. Locke wiped his forehead, lined up again in the duelist stance, and touched the tip of his baton to Sabitha's. They were using the sanctuary of the Temple of Perelandro as a practice room, under Jean's watchful eye.
"High diamond, low square," said Jean. "Go!"
This was more an exercise in speed and precision than actual fighting technique. They slammed their batons together in the patterns demanded by Jean, and after the final contact they were free to swipe at one another, scoring touches against arms or legs. Clack, 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 the sound of their batons echoed across the stone-walled chamber. Clack, clack, clack. Clack, clack, thump. Yow! Said Locke, shaking his left wrist, where a fresh red welt was rising.
You're faster than this, Locke. Sabatha returned to her starting position. Something distracting you this morning?
Sabatha wore a loose white tunic and black silk knee breeches that left nothing about her lithely muscled legs to the imagination. Her cheeks were flushed, her hair pulled tightly back with linen cord. If she'd heard anything specific about the disturbance he'd kicked off to start the day, at least she wasn't saying much.
More than one something? She said. Any of them attached to me?
So much for the lukewarm comfort of uncertainty.
You know I'm attached to you,
said Locke, trying to sound cheerful as they touched batons again.
Or might like to be,
Middle square, yelled Jean. Middle square, middle diamond, go!
They wove their pattern of strikes and counter-strikes, rattling their batons off one another until the end of the sequence, when Sabatha flicked Locke's weapon down and smacked a painful crease into his right biceps. Sabatha's only commentary on this victory was to idly twirl her baton while Locke rubbed at his arm.
Hold it, said Jean. We'll try a new exercise. Locke, stand there with your hands at your sides. Sabatha, you just hit him until you get tired. Be sure to concentrate on his head so he won't feel anything.
Very funny, Locke lined up again. I'm ready for another.
He was nothing of the sort. At the end of the next pattern, Sabatha slapped him on the right biceps again. And again, following the pattern after that, with precision that was obviously deliberate.
You know, most days you can at least manage to hit back, she said. Want to give it up as a bad job?
Of course not, said Locke, trying to be subtle about wiping the nascent tears from the corners of his eyes. Barely getting started.
Have it your way.
She lined up again, and Locke couldn't miss the coldness of her poise. Ah, gods! When Sabatha felt she was being trifled with, she had a way of radiating the same calm, chilly regard that Locke imagined might pass from executioner to condemned victim. He knew all too well what it meant to be the object of that regard.
High diamond, said Jean warily, apprehending the change in Sabatha's mood. Middle square, low cross, go.
They flew through the patterns with furious speed, Sabatha setting the pace and Locke straining to match her. The instant the last stroke of the formal exercise was made, Locke flew into a guard position that would have deflected any blow aimed at his much-abused right biceps. Sabatha, however, was actually aiming for a point just above his heart, and the hotly stinging slap nearly knocked him over.
"Gods above," said Jean, stepping between them. "You know the rules, Sabatha. No cuts at anything but arms or legs."
"Are there rules in a tavern brawl or an alley fight?"
"This isn't a damned alley fight. It's just an exercise for building vigor."
"Doesn't seem to be working for one of us."
"What's gotten into you?"
"What's gotten into you, Jean? Are you going to stand in front of him for the rest of his life?"
"Hey, hey," said Locke,
stepping around Jean and attempting to hide a considerable amount of pain behind a disingenuous smile.
"All's well, Jean."
"All's not well," said Jean.
"Someone is taking this far too seriously."
"Stand aside, Jean," said Sabatha. "If he wants to stick his hand in a fire, he can learn to pull it out himself."
"He is right here, thank you very much, and he is fine," said Locke. "It's fine, Jean. Let's have another pattern."
"Sabatha needs to calm down."
"Aren't I calm?" said Sabatha. "Locke can have quarter any time he asks for it."
"I don't choose to yield just yet," said Locke,
with what he hoped was a charming devil-may-care sort of grin. Sabatha's countenance only darkened in response.
"However, if you're concerned about me, you can back off to any degree you prefer."
"Oh, no."
Sabatha was anything but calm.
"No, no, no. I don't withdraw. You yield, deliberately, or we keep going until you can't stand up."
"That might take a while," said Locke. "Let's see if you have the patience."
"Damn it, when will you learn that refusing to admit you've lost isn't the same as winning?"
"Sort of depends on how long one keeps refusing, doesn't it?"
Sabatha scowled, an expression that cut Locke more deeply than any baton lash. Staring fixedly at him, she took her baton in both hands, snapped it over her knee, and bounced the pieces off the floor.
"Forgive me, gentlemen," she said. "I seem to be unable to conform to the intended spirit of this exercise."
She turned and left. When she'd vanished into the rear hall of the temple, Locke let out a dejected sigh.
"Gods," he said, "what the hell is going on between us? What happened just now?"
"She has a cruel streak, that one," said Jean.
"No more than any of us," said Locke, more hotly than he might have intended.
"Well, we've got some philosophical differences, to be sure."
"She's a perfectionist."
Jean picked up the broken halves of Sabatha's baton.
"And you're a real idiot from time to time."
"What did I do, besides fail to be a master baton duelist?" Locke massaged some of the tender reminders Sabatha had left him of her superior technique. "I didn't train with Don Maranzala."
"Neither did she."
"Well, come on, how does that make me an idiot?"
"You're no Sansa," said Jean, "but you can certainly be one sharp stab in the ass. Look, you'd have stood here and let her slap you into paste just for the sake of being in the same room with her. I know it, you know it, she knows it."
"Well,
It's not endearing, Locke. You don't court a girl by inviting her to abuse you from sunrise to sunset."
"Really? That sounds an awful lot like courtship in every story I've ever read."
"I mean literally abused, as in getting pounded into bird shit with a wooden stick. It's not charming or impressive. It just makes you look silly."
"Well, she doesn't like it when I beat her at anything. She's certainly not going to respect me if I give up. So just what the hell can I do?"
"No idea. Maybe I see some things clearer than you because I'm not bloody infatuated. But what to actually do with the pair of you, gods know."
"You're a deep well of reassurance."
"On the bright side," said Jean, "I'm sure you're higher in her esteem right now than the Sansas."
"Sweet gods, that's sickly praise."
Locke leaned against a wall and stretched. "Speaking of Sansas, did you see Chain's face when we woke him up this morning?"
"I wish I hadn't. He's going to break those two over his knee like Sabatha's stick.
Where do you think he stomped off to?"
"No idea. I've never seen him leave angry before the sun was even up."
"What in all the hells is going on with us?" said Locke. "This whole summer has been one long exercise in getting everything wrong."
"Chains muttered to me a few nights ago," said Jean, fiddling with the broken baton. "Something about awkward years. Said he might have to do something about us being all pent up together.
Hope that doesn't mean more apprenticeships. I'm really not in the mood to go learn another temple's rituals and then pretend to kill myself."
"No idea what it means, but..."
"Hey, you two!"
Galdo Sansa appeared out of the rear corridor, the spitting image of Carlo, save for the fact that his skull was shaven clean of every last speck of hair.
"Tubby and the training dummy! Chains his back! Wants us in the kitchen with a quickness! And what did you do to Sabatha this time?"
"I exist," said Locke. "Some days that's enough."
"You should make some friends in the Gilded Lilies, mate," said Galdo. "Why fall on your face trying to tame a horse when you can have a dozen that are already saddled?"
"So now you like to fuck horses," said Jean. "Bravo, Baldy."
"Laugh all you will. We're in demand over there," said Galdo. "Favorite guests, command performances."
"I'm sure you're popular," said Jean with a yawn. "Who doesn't like getting paid for fast, easy work?"
"I'll say a prayer for you next time I'm having it with two at once," said Galdo. "Maybe the gods will hear me and let your stones drop. But seriously, chains came in the river entrance, and I think we're all about to die."
"Well, hurrah," said Locke. "When the weather's like this, who honestly wants to live?"
3. The Father Chains waiting in the Glass Burrow's kitchen wasn't wearing any of his usual guises or props. No canes or staves to lean on, no robes, no look of sly benevolence on that craggy bearded face. He was dressed to be out and about in the city, heavily sweated with exertion, and all the furrows in his forehead seemed to meet in an ominous valley above his fierce dark eyes. Locke was unsettled. He'd rarely seen Chains glower like that at an enemy or a stranger, let alone at his apprentices. Locke noticed that everyone else was keeping a certain instinctive distance from Chains. Sabatha sat on a counter, well away from anyone, arms folded. The Sansas sat near one another more out of old habit than present warmth. Their appearances were divergent, Carlo with his long, oiled, well-tended tresses, and Galdo scraped smooth as a prize-fighter. The twins shared no jokes, no gestures, no small talk.
"I suppose it's only fair to begin," said Chains, "by apologizing for having failed you all."
Said Locke, stepping forward. "How have you failed us exactly?"
"My mentorship. My responsibility to not allow our happy home to turn into a seething pit of mutual aggravation, which it has."
Chains coughed, as though he'd irritated his throat merely by bringing such words out.
"I thought I might ease up on the regimen of previous summers. Fewer lessons, fewer errands, fewer tests. I hoped that without constraints you might blossom. Instead, you've rooted yourselves deep without flowering."
"Hold on," said Carlo. "It hasn't been such an unwelcome break, has it? And we've been training. Jean's seen to it that we've kept up with battering one another about."
"That's hardly your principal form of exercise these days," said Chains. "I've heard things from the Lilies. You two spend more time in bed than invalids. Certainly more than you spend planning or practicing our work."
"So we haven't run a game on anyone for a few weeks," said Carlo. "Is the fucking Eldrin fire falling? Who gives a damn if we take some ease? What should we be doing, sir? Learning more Vadrin? More dances? A 17th way to hold knives and forks?"
"You snot-nosed Grand Duke of Insolence," said Chains, growing louder with each word. "You ignorant, wet-eared, copper-chasing shit-barge puppy! Do you have any idea what you've been given? What you've worked for? What you are?"
"What I am is tired of being yelled at."
10 years under my roof,"
said Chains, looming over Carlo like an ambulatory mountain, suffused with moral indignation.
10 years under my protection, eating at my table, nurtured by my hand and coin. Have I beaten you, buggered you, put you out in the rain?"
"No," said Carlo, cringing. "No, of course not."
"Then you can stand one god's damned rebuke without flapping your jaw."
"Of course," said Carlo, most meekly. "Sorry."
"You're educated thieves," said Chains. "No matter how you might think it profits you to feign otherwise, you are not ordinary. You can pass for servants, farmers, merchants, nobles. You have the poise and manners for any station. If I hadn't let you grow so callow, you might realize what an unprecedented personal freedom you all possess."
Locke reflexively opened his mouth to deliver some smooth assuagement, but the merest half-second flick of Chain's glare was more than enough to keep him mute.
"What do you think this is all for?" said Chains. "What do you suppose it's all been in aid of? So you can laze around and work the occasional petty theft, drink and whore and dice with the other right people until you get called out or hung? Have you seen what happens to our kind? How many of your bright-eyed little chums will live to see 25? If they scrape 30, they're God's damned elders. You think they have money tucked away, villas in the country? Thieves may prosper night by night, but there's nothing for them when the lean times come. Do you understand?"
"But there's Garistas," said Galdo, "and the Carper, and a lot of older types at the floating grave."
"Indeed," said Chains. "Carpers and Garistas don't go hungry, because they can take scraps from the mouths of their brothers and sisters. And how do you suppose you get to grow old in the Carper's service? You guard his doors with an alley piece, like a constable on the beat. You watch your friends hang and die in the gutters and get called up for teeth lessons because they said the wrong thing in their cups or held back a few silvers one fucking time. You put your head down and shut up forever. That's what earns you some grey hair." "No justice," he continued sourly. "No true fellowship. Vows in darkness, that's all. Valid until the first time someone goes hungry or needs a few coins. Why do you think I've raised you to wink at the secret peace? We're like a sick dog that gnaws its own entrails. The right people are. But you've got a chance to live in real trust and fellowship, to be thieves as the gods intended, scourging the swells and living true to yourselves. I'll be damned before I'll let you forget what a gift you've been given in one another.
No smart remark ever could stand before the gale of this sort of chastisement. Locke noted that he wasn't the only one with a sudden overwhelming compulsion to stare at the floor.
And so, I need to apologize for my own failure.
Chains drew a folded letter from his coat.
For allowing us to reach this pretty state of affairs, falling out with one another and forgetting ourselves. It's a bad time for all of you. Your confused bundles of nerves and passion, cooped up down here where you can do maximum damage to your mutual regard. You've certainly been disagreeable company for me. I've decided I need a vacation.
Well then, said Jean, where will you be going?
Going? Drinking, I suppose. Perhaps I'll go see old Maranzala. And I've a mind to hunt down some chamber music. But forgive me if I've been unclear. I require a vacation from all of you, but I'm not leaving Camor. You five will be making a journey to Espara. I've arranged work there to keep you busy for several months.
Espara? Said Locke.
Yes. Isn't it exciting?
The room was quiet.
I thought that might be your response. Look, I tucked a pin into my jacket for this very moment.
Chains drew a silver pin from one of his lapels and tossed it into the air. It hit the floor with the faintest chiming clatter.
One of those expressions I've always wanted to put to the test, said Chains. But seriously, you're out, all of you. Evicted. There's a wagon caravan leaving from the Chenza Gate on Duke's Day. You've got 2 days to make yourselves part of it. After that, it's a week and a half to Espara.
But, said Carlo, what if we don't want to go to bloody Espara?
Then leave and don't come back to this temple, said Chains. Forfeit everything. In fact, leave Camor. I won't want to see you again anywhere.
What's in Espara that's so important? Said Sabatha.
Your partnership. It's past time it was put to a real test, far beyond my reach. Take all your years of training and make something of them. False face together, rely upon one another, and come back alive. Prove that we haven't been wasting our time down here. Prove it to me, and prove it to yourselves.
Chains held up the folded letter.
You're going to Espara to enjoy a career on the stage.
4.
After my soldiering ended, continued Chains, and before I came back to Camor, I indulged in several vices, not the least of which was acting. I fell in with a troupe in Espara run by the single unluckiest thick-skulled son of a bitch that ever crawled out of a womb, Jasmer Moncrane. I saved his life by design, and he saved mine by accident. We've kept in touch across the years.
Oh, gods, said Sabatha, you're sending us in payment of a debt.
No, no. Jasmer and I are square. The favor is mutual. I need the five of you occupied elsewhere. Jasmer has desperate need of players, and an equally desperate need to avoid paying them.
So it is questionable circumstances, then?
Oh, never doubt. I get the impression from his letters that he's one mistake away from being chained up for debt. I'd appreciate you preventing that. He wants to do Lucarno's Republic of Thieves. Your story will be that you're a band of up-and-coming thespians from Camor. I sent a letter ahead of you telling him how to play the angles right. The rest is entirely up to you.
Do you have a copy of the letter for us? Said Locke.
Nah.
Well then, what shall we do about...
Chains tossed a jingling bag at Locke's head. Locke barely managed to pluck it out of the air before it struck his nose.
Oh, look, a bag of money. That's all the help you'll be getting from me, my boy.
But aliases, travel arrangements...
Your problem, not mine.
We don't know anything about the stage.
You know about costumes, make-up, elocution, and deportment. Everything else you can learn once you get there.
But...
Look, said Chains, I don't want to spend the rest of the day interrupting your questions, so I'm going to temporarily forget how to make words come out of my mouth. I'll be nursing a chilled bottle of Vadron White over at the Tumble home until further notice. Remember the caravan. 2 days. You can be part of it, or you can leave the gentleman bastards. Your time is henceforth your own.
He left the kitchen in a state of extreme self-satisfaction. A few moments later, Locke heard the creak and slam of the burrow's concealed riverside exit. Locke and his cohorts traded a sincere set of bewildered looks.
"Well, this is a fist-fuck and a flaming oil-bath," said Carlo.